Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
And welcome to The Food Scene. I'm Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Pablo Johnson. Now, I love that you have a website, pablo.com, your first name, but let's talk to people about how you spell that name and why you spell that name that way.
I spell my name, Pablo, spelled in the South Louisiana fashion, or the imaginary South Louisiana fashion. It is P-A-B-L-E-A-U-X. And that is a name that was my writing byline, and it became that because it was previously my college nickname. I come from I grew up in French Catholic South Louisiana in a place called New Iberia, which is a little town in Cajun country, and there my name was for the majority of my life was Paul Johnson. The story I tell about that is my mother's maiden name was Carmelite Laurel Hebert. Her father was of Cajun descent, and so she had a beautiful poetic name. She married a guy named Phil Johnson, and I became Paul Johnson in one generation.
Oh man!
But I went to college in San Antonio, Texas, and a little liberal arts school there. And people started calling me the Spanish version of my name, which then became, I started spelling it the way I would back home, as a lark. And so that became my nickname during college. And then afterwards, when I started writing about, let's say, 5 or so years later, nobody would remember my actual name because it gives you no traction. And so I ended up just started sending out, using Pablo as my byline. And if you put a silent X on something, an editor can't forget it,
yeah,
for better or for worse.
Well, you know, that silent X, too, begs the question, is this man Cajun? And, I mean, you already answered that. Mm-hmm. But what is Cajun? And is it something similar to Creole, or are they completely disparate things?
They are very, very different things. I mean, the easiest way to describe what Cajun culture is in modern day, expression, it is the culture that is in South Louisiana below I-10. I-10 is our basic dividing line that runs about 20 miles north of the Gulf of Mexico, all the width of the state. Below that, it tends to be, you know, people who were descended from the Acadians, who were what is now modern-day Nova Scotia. They were kicked out in 1755. They were rejected by the British when it was called Acadie, and it was a French it was a French colony from 1608 to 1755. Those people were forcibly ejected. Families were put on boats, often separated by the British at that particular time. There's a longer story to that, but it's a they were basically sent away in diaspora.
Yeah, but I mean, this link to Nova Scotia too is a fascinating thing, because I think a lot of people assume that Cajun culture is grounded in Louisiana, that the people of area.
It is, and it developed in that way. I mean, it's the origins are in Nova Scotia, but what they had was roughly, it took them about 10 years to get, for them to reach critical mass in a part of, in a very, very swampy and prairie country in the Louisiana coast, because it was, you know, it was 1755. You just didn't get on a plane. But it took them, since then, that part of the country was really of not a whole lot of interest to anybody, because it was, you know, kind of swamp and prairie, you know, swamp and coastal prairie. until they found oil there. So a lot of those cultural elements were able to evolve on their own for basically over 100 years, almost 200.
Is this something growing up there that is just ingrained in your system that you can recite back, or is it because you've written 3 books about Louisiana food culture that you're able to recite it so well?
I spend a lot of time explaining different parts of Louisiana to people and Louisiana culture to people because they are in the contemporary mind from outside of that particular place. A lot of times they get mushed together. Like people will think that the traditions of New Orleans are remarkably different from Cajun country. But people found Cajun food through Paul Prudhomme, who was at that particular time cooking at a restaurant in New Orleans. And so people are very enthusiastic about Louisiana culture. They just often don't know the differences between the two.
I always thought, actually, what was that actor's name? That Dom DeLuise was Paul Prudhomme. I always thought it was a character, not a real person. I apologize.
A lot of our people tend to be shaped that way as yeah. well. So,
but like
people of appetites.
Yeah, but like you said, you know, there are these not preconceptions, but these kind of packaged items that come out of New Orleans that represent the state as a whole. I mean, mm-hmm. even like Zatarain's, mm-hmm. you know, their spice mix. But when, first of all, how do you say New Orleans as if you're from there?
It varies neighborhood to neighborhood, if you can believe it. One of my favorite is people from a lot of people from the Gentilly neighborhood of New Orleans say New Orleans, which is one of the most beautiful ways to pronounce the name of the city. In a similar way that people you find something that is distinctive about the way that people say it. You basically say New Orleans. Sometimes it's shortened slightly. It is almost never New Orleans, as people lean into that a whole lot. But New Orleans is one of those cities that is amazing because it's human scale and because it's American standards, kind of an ancient city. It's really easy to fall in love with. And it is very beloved by many. And so we usually take that as a great thing rather than as something to, the short answer to that was no one says New Orleans. Nobody. That's something that you do it if you really need to rhyme something in a song.
Hey, the animals. I think that's the only time I've ever had someone.
Yes.
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 But, I mean, you must love Cajun culture and you know, the foods and, you know, traditions of Louisiana so much. Because when you were in Austin for college, mm-hmm. you were inviting hundreds of people to your house for gumbo.
Yes.
And you don't do that just because you want to make friends.
Part of it is that in South Louisiana, specifically South Louisiana, and to a lesser extent North Louisiana, which is functionally the South. I mean, we are, like, yes, things that are different about South Louisiana. It has historically been a predominantly French culture. It has brought different flavors of it. New Orleans is its own animal. When I tell people about Louisiana, I said there are basically 3 states. When people talk about it in terms of it being the South, capital T, capital S, like the Mason-Dixon South, you know, South Louisiana has had a French Catholic underpinnings for way longer. You know, Protestantism just didn't take in a historic sense. It's different now because of modernity, but it is predominantly French, predominantly Catholic. It has different kind of cultural cues than East Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. Those places tend to be more similar than not, and we are very, very different from that. Because, like, for a long time, like, Cajun French was a language, it's an archaic French. It was based on it was a French that is very, very different from Parisian French. Because the people who went to, people from France that come to South Louisiana, say that is they have no idea. They need a translator sometimes because it's archaic French that was, you know, like so many things with that culture. Again, these were people who chose to live very far. They were already frontiersmen and frontiersmen and fishermen in the Maritime Canada. And then they ended up in rural South Louisiana, where nobody wanted to go there because spiders, snakes, algae, etc.
You know, but they created such, and I say bubble in a good way, but such a kind of contained, not necessarily insular because of hospitality and people coming in, environment, like in legalese, I always see droit or drot. I don't even know how to say it. D-R-O-I-T. And that only exists kind of in the legalese of New Orleans, like that statuette. And I don't know why, but I feel like it's the same thing as po' boys or beignets. Like it's not a po' boy or a beignet if it's not contained within that zone, within that region.
These, I mean, and the, going back to the original thing about, you know, when I was living elsewhere, and I lived in, I spent a lot of my adult life in Austin, Texas, and I've been living in New Orleans for, so I grew up in rural South Louisiana, alternated years working and traveling for about five. Then after trying to go to grad school and it not working out at all, I went to Austin, Texas, and was there for about 10 years. And then that's where, and then when you go to other places and you're from Louisiana, you realize that one of the things that unifies you is we always talk about food. You know, in the same way that New Yorkers are always talking about, you know, rent real estates and et cetera, and train construction. In the same way that people in D.C. always talk about politics. Same way that people in L.A. always talk about show business in some way, shape, or form. We're always talking about food. You know, it's a very, very participatory thing, not just in terms of, oh, what are the great restaurants, but it's like, it's what do you cook? How do you make your gumbo? How do you make your red beans? How is it different? How are they similar? One of the kind of the tropes that often that people say a lot is that you will be sitting there having the, you know, just an absolutely mind-bendingly good lunch, telling a story about another mind-bendingly good dinner that you had. But, oh, this reminds me of this, and it's very much in that way a storytelling culture that is kind of unified in a culinary way.
But you are a storyteller. I mean, you are an accomplished photographer, journalist, and I think what you really love doing most is having people sit at your grandmother's table and eating with them, so stories can be abound.
Yes.
Do you? I know you equally care about the food, but how important is it to have conversation over those meals?
Part of the thing about, you know, in South Louisiana, you are unified by the table, you know, and that's mine is a little bit different also because I come from a big family and I'm from a big family within a big family. So I grew up at my grandmother's table because we would go to my grandmother's house every chance. They lived in Baton Rouge, which is about 90 miles from where I grew up. But my mother was very close to her sisters. And so anytime she was one of eight kids. So we grew up at my grandmother's kitchen table, not the dining room table, because the dining room table is a place where you had to put on, you know, kind of a not comfortable shirt and sit up straight. The kitchen table was where the action was. And we, over the years, when I moved from Austin to New Orleans, my grandfather had passed away, and I was the one who got the table because I had the room for it, because my apartment, you know, first moved to New Orleans was huge. I decided to start kind of using the tradition, like as you mentioned before. What I did in Austin was, once every 3 months or so, I would cook a variation on a Thanksgiving thing called turkey bone gumbo, which I adapted to Texas because I couldn't make a seafood gumbo in Austin at that time in my life because it would have cost $1 million. And we like, one of the things is, again, coming from both South Louisiana that shares this with also being from a big family, is that I have no culinary sense of scale.
Yeah.
So like I had worked in some kitchens, but you get the same feeling with people who kind of work at different restaurants where you're making things for 30, 40, 50 people. That's your batches.
Oh, it's kind of like when my wife makes soup, she makes soup for the week.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So in cooking big, instead of doing it like that, like once every 3 months, I would do an afternoon party. It would be on a Sunday, and I would do gumbo and red beans. And the gumbos were huge. And eventually, you know, by the time we left, it was like 150 to 200 people over the course of the afternoon, just kind of an open house. And everybody would come by and eat. And when I got to New Orleans, I didn't have the backyard to do that. And so I said, okay, well, I've got this table. I have, and so I said, I'm going to make red beans. A friend of mine in Austin had taught me how to use a pressure cooker. So I knew that I could make red beans fairly quickly. So I just made that the default for that. So every Monday I knew that I was going to be making red beans. The pressure cooker made it easy to do in terms of timing. And I would just invite whoever could come. And I've been there for almost 16 years. So every Monday for about 15 or 16 years, I've had a table. I have a 10 top in my 10 to 12 top in my house. And I just invite, it's completely run by Kismet, whoever comes by or whoever is in town or, hey, my friends are coming over, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If there's room, I feed them because I keep it amazingly simple and amazingly elemental. I cook red beans, and that's a very adaptable dish because you can do it as vegetarian or you can do it with andouille from a place called La Place, Louisiana, which is just some of the best smoked meat in the wide world. That and cornbread, and that's it. There is no green salad. There is no additional things, and we have whiskey for dessert. So it's a the rules are simple. You bring what you want to drink. It's not fancy. It is amazingly casual. It is not a dinner party. It is supper. And so you end up with a bunch of different people who have sat at that table. So and that's kind of that's the local version of that. That's before it ever went on the road. It was that ritual. It was a Monday ritual that always had good conversation and, different, and everybody wants to drink wine on a Monday night.
Yeah. Well, what's kind of amazing is that this is a Tuesday taping, and I know you did red beans yesterday because it was a Monday. But we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come right back and talk more to Pablo Johnson about his Red Beans Roadshow.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com. The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Here again with Pablo Johnson, Pablo.com, and don't forget that silent X. So, the Red Beans Roadshow. I know as a fact that you've had lovely people over at your house, like my friends Jenny and Nick, who stopped by a few months ago. But I've also heard stories about some guy named Benedict Cumberbatch stopping by the house as well. And talk about kismet. I mean, who in the world has been to your house for this thing?
I mean, it's literally whoever I run into that week. I mean,
so you just ran into Benedict Cumberbatch.
That happened accidentally. I forget what year it was. He was down there apparently doing 12 Years a Slave. Had no idea. I had called some friends of mine. She is a research librarian and burlesque dancer, and he is a clarinet player. And called them one summer day, and I said, "Hey, you guys want to? You guys want to come? Because we've got room at the table. Because it's all based on if there's room at the table." And they said, "Sure, do you mind if we bring a friend?" It's like, "Sure, absolutely." And so it's like, so they came, and they were there, and I just kind of said hello to them on the porch. And I looked up, and it was like, I had already seen the BBC stuff. It was before he became really, really huge here, but it was like, but I had watched the BBC stuff and really, really enjoyed it and kind of went, huh. And he goes, "Hello, I'm Ben." It's like,
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great. Know who you are. Come on in. Have a good time. And it was interesting. That was like one evening. It was a really good time. But my niece, who's 16 years old right now, that's amazing amounts of good fortune to have for that niche. She goes, where's the cherry sat in? It's like, settle down.
You know, recently Epicurious called you one of the 100 greatest home cooks of all time. I love that. That was almost a spit take. But, part of that is obviously being able to cook. But I think the other part is hospitality and kind of the ambience that you set. And from hearing those stories and knowing you well enough, the way you set the table, the way you set the scene, the way you invite people in, makes you like any other home cook that I know.
Part of that is that's just ingrained. I mean, that was, what I've often, I took a lot of cues from my grandmother, Elizabeth Laurel Seal, my mama's mama, who basically, that was her kitchen table. She was bossy when she had to be. She was very welcoming. She had 8 kids, and she fed them and all their friends. So having that open door policy is kind of a hallmark of that part of the country. It's like you would never come in through the front door. You always come in, through the door in the kitchen. So if the doorbell rang, you knew it was somebody you didn't want to talk to. but I've learned the whole thing about the it's an honor to be on that list. It's a very great honor to be on that list. But it's basically the same thing as the Trogs being in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It's like they had one song. They just had the one song. This is I do 3 or 4 dishes well. I do them enough. Just like any grandmother. It's like this is all mama food. You do it a million times where you can do it in your sleep. This is the, I accepted that as my friends gave me grief, because they know my range and that my range is amazingly limited. But it is I accepted for my grandmother and all the grandmothers who don't do that. I accepted it in their stead.
You do it well enough though to take it on the road. In 2009... Red Beans Roadshow began. And why was it important for you to take it out of your house and
on the road? So I tend to travel a lot. So my primary stuff has been a food and travel writer and a photographer. I have a lot of friends in a lot of different places. It started in New York, God, a million years ago, in like 1991, when a buddy of mine who's living in Brooklyn said, hey, you better get here quick because we're going to have 25 people over here for gumbo at his place in Park Slope in 91. So we got to shop and we got to cook. We got 25 people coming on Sunday. So we did. And then we made it happen. It was fun. A lot of times people want to have Louisiana food in other places. And it's a chance to, if I'm like, when I travel, whenever I can, I stay with my friends. Because it's my chance to, when you have a sleepover, you get to have long talks. You get to stay connected to people in ways that you wouldn't otherwise.
The whiskey helps too.
Whiskey does not hurt. Whiskey does not hurt. But we did a... I started doing that in 2009. I took a one-year job in Louisville, Kentucky, at a newspaper there. And that ended up not working out. I was going on the way back and decided I was going to spend that summer driving. And I basically just bought a bunch of andouille and red beans and went from place to place cooking in my friends' homes and kind of doing that as a proto version of what was to come later. That was a travel project. That was just an excuse to do some writing and see my friends and cook for their friends. What I started doing in 2015 is I had enough, I'd been cooking in, at my house at that point for 13, 14 years. And a friend of mine, Ann Cashin, who runs a place called Johnny's Half Shell in D.C., said, hey, listen, we talked about doing this at my restaurant. We should do it. And I did what I did every time. I said, yeah, we really should. We absolutely should. I've had a bunch of different restaurant people come through and be guests. Oftentimes friends of friends. Hey, I got some friends coming. Any friend of mine any friend of a friend of mine, is my friend. So it's like are they going to be here on Monday? Sure. If there's room, then they can come. So what Anne had said was, we've talked about this a lot. We should do it. And I said, yeah, try to do the runaround. And she said, you know, we should do that now. We'll figure it out now. And we kind of like figured out the best way to do it at her restaurant, which was then on Capitol Hill, is now in Adams Morgan. But it's like, it's what do you need to pull this off? What do you need to clone this table that, you know, we do in New Orleans every Monday and make it work in a restaurant setting for people who you may or may not know?
Well, I mean, also, what goes in red beans? I know it's red beans. Is it specifically kidney?
It is. They are kidney beans. In New Orleans, they specifically use a brand called Camellia, which is, and, you know, it is one of those things that is a, you know, it's always ask a grandma.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that is the one where it's like, you have to have those. And Camellia is now a sponsor of the Red Beans Roadshow.
And then you have to use the Trinity, right? You can't use Mirepoix.
It is me. I don't even know what Mirepoix is. No, in mine, I put onions, bell pepper, garlic as the primary saute. So it's like, I don't even use celery. You know, it's usually the Trinity is part of the celery. And sometimes they people say that you can add garlic as the Holy Ghost if you want to use it to extend that particular Catholic metaphor.
Yeah, and then spices, thyme has to be in there?
No, I don't use thyme. Everybody's recipes for the things that you make are very, very personal. Your gumbo is very personal. Your red beans are very personal. Suzanne Whitaker, who is my high school speech coach, I was back for college, and she was making red beans, and I said, what is that flavor? It's amazing. And it was sweet basil. So it's salt, pepper, whatever spice mix you have. I use a thing called Tony Chachere's. But the... now I'm trying to do the thing in my head. It's almost completely ingrained. Bay leaf, dried sweet basil, and then you finish it off with minced black pepper. I'm sorry, minced flat leaf parsley and green onions. It's an amazingly simple dish, and you use like I said, you use the I use this. I've come to use kind of a smoke heavy sausage from. A place called Laplace, Louisiana, which is the river parishes upriver from New Orleans, which is where the Germans settled. So it's like that's what's called the German coast. So their andouille is not French andouille. Their andouille is basically, it's all shoulder meat. So it's like it's spiced with salt, pepper, and garlic, and red pepper often. And they just smoke it over oak. So it's wonderful. It's like the core of a country.
Here. I mean, this is real soul food. This is what Louis Armstrong professes his favorite dish.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it still holds true the same way as when it was served to Old Satchmo?
I mean, it's all these things are so personal. I mean, it's you know, in a lot of ways, you know, red beans became a Monday tradition in New Orleans because it was tied to pre-industrial domestic routines. Monday was wash day. And so, you know, the kitchen help or the lady of the house had to go, and on Monday, that's the day that you would do your laundry, which was not throwing it into a machine. It was going down to the river and washing it in the river. So you needed something that could be put on a banked fire that could simmer all day and would be delicious. And so red beans became that thing that you always saw. It was in restaurants. It was in school cafeterias. It was in people's houses. And so that became associated with that day.
Yeah.
When you ask different people, and again, that's where a lot of this culinary conversation comes up. It's like, huh, well, how do you do your red beans? You know, there are some people who wouldn't imagine it. There's a thing called pickled pork, which is a very, very city thing. And getting back to the differences in the geographical differences, in a lot of ways, you know, New Orleans is like New York. It is like no other place. You know, you can't say, oh, well, New York is just like, New Orleans is just like, and it's not like the area around it at all. So Cajun and Creole are very, very different in that way. New Orleans is, red beans is a very, very New Orleans thing. It's kind of been accepted as a pan-Louisiana thing as time goes by. But that's when people use pickled pork, some people use a ham bone, some people, and so everybody has their different way of approaching that dish. And that's, I'd like, I just, I've locked onto mine and that and tried to over time make it transportable.
Yeah, I feel like there are just so many long-standing constants in New Orleans, like Muffaletta's at Central Grocery, at Touffet, Bananas Foster at Brennan's, Beignets at Café du Monde. Mm-hmm. And then when people try to stray away from them, that's when the locals or the greater culinary community tries to rein them back in. Do you think that does a service or disservice to New Orleans? Like, do you like seeing riffs on po' boys or muffaletta's, or do you care about the traditional tried and true way that it's always been done?
I mean, there are certain things that you do because, you know, they're done best there. You know, I don't have Louisiana food outside Louisiana. It doesn't come up because when I'm traveling, I want to do, if people are coming to New Orleans and they want to have, you kind of want to have New Orleans food where it is. I wouldn't go to New Orleans. I wouldn't suggest that somebody from New York come to New Orleans and have great New York style pizza. I just wouldn't do it because in the same way, like I wouldn't try that in other places. People are going to do what they're going to do, and that's fine. But you know, it's part of it is looking at different aspects of the culture and where it grew up and how it did, and how it continues to evolve in a lot of ways. But like red beans and rice are red beans and rice, period. You know that there's certain kinds of like culinary nostalgia associated with that. Like there's certain kinds of gumbo that I like because they were similar to the ones that were served in public school cafeterias in Iberia Parish and in the 70s and 80s, and in certain kinds of breads that were baked in that context as well. That stuff goes deep, and that's kind of why it's one of the cornerstones of our culture.
I also just feel like you care so much about archiving as a photojournalist. Portfolios you've done of second lines of Indians, and you can explain better what mm-hmm. that is, aren't the Mardi Gras and Jazz Fest everyone else knows New Orleans as. It's something that happens weekly, if not daily. I mean, it happens all the time there, and it kind of gets glossed over for these fantastical, singular events or days that happen.
Well, I mean, New Orleans is, there's so much to love about it, and that's why, again, that's why it's a very, very beloved city. It also has kind of these intact cultures that are still practiced every year to year, week to week in some cases, that are, if you know where to go and you know where to see them, they're just absolutely overwhelming in an experiential way. One of them is the Social Aid and Pleasure Club tradition, which people know as Second Lines. The thing that people tend to know more about is the, it looks like a jazz funeral in a way. It is also tied into, they're presented by these things called Social Aid and Pleasure Clubs, which are in the immigrant, the Italian American societies that they had in East Coast cities. There were people from, but instead of being like tied to, that we're all Hungarians, we were in this neighborhood, and a lot of them were, people lived in that neighborhood were African-American longshoremen. They would have these different like kind of neighborhood-based groups that have been around basically since the 1880s. And every year, each one of those clubs would have, on a Sunday, would have a street parade. And it's one band, probably, anywhere from, say, six to ten instruments. And they're dressed in these amazingly kind of technicolor zoot suits. So it's basically elaborate street dance that is done, as part of it's just what happens in the city. And the club and the band form the first line of the parade, and the crowd that goes along to dance, to sing, to experience that, is called the second line. And they've come to be called second lines. And so there's a lot, there's 39 or 40 Sundays a year. You can go to one of the, if you know where to go, it's one of these parades that, kind of like go, and it kind of moves like a clot through the city. And it's just amazing. It's just astonishing thing to see. And that's been going since the 1880s, 1890s.
Yeah. But then seeing your imagery of, I mean, the costume itself, What are Indians in a Mardi Gras fashion?
A lot of people may have, if a lot of people who like New Orleans, like really, really dove into David Simon's Treme. You know, and one of the things that they did remarkably well is, in that particular series, was present one of the primary characters was based on Mardi Gras Indian culture and what it takes to, and the way that they approach that particular craft. The Mardi Gras Indians are basically a cultural tradition which encompasses music, dance, and amazingly intricate craft work, sewing specifically, to make really very elaborate Indian suits that have amazingly difficult beadwork. Basically, they're Technicolor suits. They look like basically Buffalo Bill's Wild West show, but in absolute Technicolor. The like Plains Indians models done with Plains Indian, you know, costume cues that are done in these amazing bright colors. It also has a much deeper tradition in, if you listen to the music, ethnomusicologists listen to this stuff, they say these are basically the same songs, rhythms, there's no instruments to it. It's traditionally a cappella and drums, which are also considered a kind of drum. The handiwork is similar to the kind of Haiti, what were called voodoo flags. It's a very, very intricate kind of sewing where you're doing embroidery with small beads, sequins, rhinestones, sewn into these amazing costumes. In fact, Jessica Harris showed me, you know, has done a lot of the stuff. She also has a podcast on this network, or did. They have a very particular tradition on probably 8 or 9 days a year. On Mardi Gras Day, on St. Joseph's Night, on these three events called Super Sundays, which are daytime things where those are for the community so people can see their work. And during Jazz Fest, you can also see them. If you've been to the Jazz Fest, one of the stages of Jazz Fest is usually dedicated to both of these kind of cultures. They have to make a new suit every year, and it's amazingly labor-intensive. So learning more and more about those different cultures and about the people who do them, because it's really easy to see them and say, oh, well, it's a Mardi Gras costume, and it's anything but. It's something that's much, much more deeper and labor-intensive to do that, because you literally have to sew these tiny little beads that are, you know, if you can imagine the size of a chest patch of an average-sized person, and imagine it covered with little pixels that are half the size of a grain of rice. And then you say, oh, that's not just something they bought. That's not just something that whatever. They had to sew that into heavy canvas, bleeding into the canvas. And they do it every year. And it's amazing. Learning more about that and learning more about how these, you know, people create and maintain this culture is astonishing. And again, it doesn't happen anywhere
else. Well, you are one of those people maintaining and letting this culture hit the road and kind of expand people's horizons. So, and the more and more I learn about you, the more and more I adore you, your culture, and want to get my ass back to New Orleans.
Come on.
As soon as possible, especially on a Monday. And if you're ever there on a Monday and want some red beans, and you're a friend of mine, I am more than willing to introduce you to Pablo himself. But check out his website, pablo.com, or redbeansroadshow.com, to see where he is on the road. But as always, thank you. And again, I really hope to see you back in New Orleans soon. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.